Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth lecture of the Mises Academy class, Production in the Market Process, where we're going through the middle section of Man, Economy, and State. Tonight, we're focusing on, I assigned the first half of Chapter 8. So here we're dealing with, this is my favorite part of the book. This is the stuff that my doctoral dissertation dealt with. So I'm going to be going into some of these topics perhaps more deeply than I will do in other parts of the book, just because this is where I really, this is sort of my expertise, this stuff. So the beauty of this chapter is Rothbard is going to show you how it is in a regular market economy where the government's not messing with things, that when people decide to increase their saving, they save a higher fraction of their income, that doesn't lead to depression. That doesn't lead to a collapse in aggregate demand and then everyone gets thrown out of work. No, that leads to a sustainable expansion, that real resources are freed up for making consumer good and they can be reallocated to making producer or capital goods, and that makes us, that raises the standard of living over time. Okay, so we're going to talk about that particular aspect more next week than we are this week, but everything we're doing this week is going to be leading up to that as well. So the other benefit, besides just that and the intrinsic beauty of that, just to understand how an economy works and how savings can lead to a higher standard of living, just to see that from a macro perspective. Because just to make sure you understand, everybody understands how in a micro individual household level, if you have a certain income, you've got your paycheck, and that's going to be the same. If you save more, if you cut back your expenditures at the mall, you don't go out to eat as much, you spend less at Christmas, you don't take that cruise that you've been planning, you push it off a couple of years, and so you save more of your income, and you either put it in the bank or you put it in the stock market or you buy bonds with it or whatever you do with it, invest in a local business venture, you boost your assets, your income is going to be higher down the road. So if you just put it in the bank, now your bank balance is bigger, you earn interest on that, and so your income next year is higher than otherwise would have been, because now you're, next year you're getting your paycheck plus you're getting the interest income off of your additional savings. So everybody can see how the individual household does better by abstaining from consumption, that it raises your standard of living over time. But the tricky part is to aggregate that, to say, what if the community as a whole in general starts saving more? How does that work? And so that's one of the main things we're going to be talking about this week and next week, to see that there is no fallacy of composition as far as the Austrians are concerned. So that the fallacy of composition, for those of you who don't know that term, says that sometimes what's true of the part is not true of the whole. So for example, if you're at a sporting event, so you're in a big stadium and you can't see very well because there's people in front of you, you might stand up on your seat. And then, oh, wow, you can see just fine. But it wouldn't follow from that observation that if everybody in the stadium stood up on all the seats, that everyone in the stadium could then see better. Because, of course, the reason you can see better if you do it yourself is now you can look over the people in front of you, but if they get up on their seats, now you can't see in front of you anymore. So it all cancels out. Okay, so that's what the fallacy of composition says, that you got to watch out and don't assume that just because something is true of the part means it's true of the collective or of the whole. So the Keynesians will say, oftentimes, just because it's true that an individual household, if it saves more, does better, you can't conclude that the community as a whole does better. Because if a household saves more, that means its consumption expenditures go down, but that was somebody else's income. So the Keynesians are going to say, if every household tries to save a higher fraction of its income, it can end up reducing total income, thus frustrating the whole enterprise. That's what the paradox of thrift is. So what we're talking about this week and next week is to show specifically what do market prices do, how does the market deal with a decision by the household if they lower their time preferences and want to save more, provide more for the future physically, how does the economy adapt to that change in subjective preferences so that, how can it be the case that we have a higher standard of living in the future? What physically has to happen? That's the kind of thing we're going to go through. So it's a really wonderful piece of Austrian economic analysis that I think, this is one area where the Austrians just shine compared to other schools of thought, because the Austrians have by far the most developed capital theory. And this is, you can't tell this story without involving the structure of production. And so you need to be an Austrian to do the justice to this topic. Okay, but we can't get to the really fun stuff until we make sure we understand the first principles here. So right away in the beginning of the chapter, there's something that I realized may have puzzled you guys, and I want to spend some time on this. This almost gets philosophical, but I think it's really important for you guys to know what Rothbard is saying, because just thinking through this will help you, I believe, understand what interest really is and to get the Austrian view of rent versus income and so forth. Okay, so in the beginning of this chapter, Rothbard says, and I'm paraphrasing, he says that in the evenly rotating economy, the ERE, there are only two what he calls ultimate sources of income, namely interest and wages. And then he goes on to say, but in the real world, there's a third source of income, entrepreneurial profit. So what I realized when I was reading that is that may have confused you guys. You might have thought, wait a minute, what is he talking about? Don't those diagrams we were looking at show that in the ERE, there's three sources of income, interest to the capitalists, wages to the workers, and rent to the owners of the natural resources, or what Rothbard would call the land factors. So what does he mean? Is he saying that land doesn't earn a return in the ERE? And let me walk you through what's going on here. And so the quick answer is no, Rothbard is not saying that the owner of land earns no income in the ERE, but what he's saying is it's not the ultimate source of income, that ultimately even the landowner is earning interest, and that's how Rothbard's classifying his income. So let me show you how that works. So this is, I hesitate whether to tell you guys this because sometimes it screws people up. It's almost too much information, but what I'm about to show you illustrates a revolution in economic thought. The classical economists, they had a functional view of income where, here was total output, total income, and how did it get divided up among various classes of society? And the way the classical economists thought about it, they said some of the total output goes to the workers, and we'll call that wages. Some of it goes to the landowners, we'll call that rent. And then some of it goes to the capitalists, and we'll call that, they would call it profit. So it's what we mean by interest, or it's what we mean by profit and interest. They kind of lump that all together. And so what I'm telling you is that way of thinking will blow up in your face when you start analyzing things the way we're going to analyze it in a minute here. And because of this, what I would say is a more coherent way of thinking through income and capital and interest and so forth, that's what led Rothbard to say in the evenly rotating economy, there's really only two ultimate sources of income, interest and wages. He's not including rent to land factors, and let's see why he's doing that. So my observation there was just to show you this is an advancement in economic thought, that the classical economists didn't realize what we're about to go over, because they thought that rental payments were a separate category of income distinct from interest, and we'll see that that's not really tenable. Okay, so let's do two different thought experiments, and you'll see why you can't classify income and say, oh, some types of income goes rent to the landowners, and then a totally different type of income goes to the capitalists. So here we've got the first scenario. So suppose there's a guy in the evenly rotating economy, and let's say he's got $1 million that he's saved up. You can think about that he has it in gold ounces or in green pieces of paper if there's fiat currency. And now what does he want to do with it? So let's say the first scenario, he dumps it into bonds and he keeps rolling them over. You know, the bonds mature and he just takes the principal and buys new bonds with it. And they yield 5% per year. Okay? So that means his interest income, so his income every year is $50,000. And I gave away the game there. That's clearly interest income. Right? He has $1 million principal. He keeps buying $1 million worth of bonds. Next year, they mature into $1,050,000. Right? So somebody, a corporation that borrowed $1 million from him by giving him the bonds, to say they yielded 5% means, you know, a year later, the corporation pays him back $1 million plus $50,000 in interest. So if the guy wants to just tread water and keep his $1 million of capital intact and just keep rolling that over, that means he can derive a perpetual stream every year of $50,000. And he can go consume that if he wants, and he's fine. He's not going to whittle away his wealth if he consumes $50,000 a year because of this income stream. Okay? So the point is, he's clearly earning an income, $50,000 a year, off of this asset. How do we describe it or account for it? It's clearly interest. If that's not interest, nothing is, right? So that's clearly interest, the yield you're earning off of buying bonds. Okay, fair enough. But now, suppose instead the guy takes his $1 million initially. He doesn't buy bonds with it. Instead, there's a plot of real estate that he buys from some other landowner. So some guy owns a piece of land that's very arable. Crops can be grown on it. And so this guy with $1 million, still in the evenly rotating economy, he says, hey, I want to own that land. I don't want to own bonds. I want to own this real estate. I'll give you $1 million. There you go. Now you transfer the title to me. So I am now the owner of this piece of land. And what does he do with it? He rents it out to sharecroppers. So farmers come along. They want to use fertilizer and the rainwater and the sunshine and their own, you know, their tilling abilities and whatever, and raise crops. And of course, one of the crucial ingredients to farming is you need farmland, soil, and that's what this guy now is able to provide. So he doesn't sell them the land, he instead lets them rent its use from him. And the market price that he charges is such that he earns from them $50,000 per year. So, you know, maybe he rents it to them per month or something, but the point is, over the course of a year, they pay him $50,000. And they are just renting the use of the land. He still is the owner of the land. In the ERE, every period, things repeat themselves. So the value of his land, the market price of his land, is $1 million every period. The land doesn't deteriorate. Okay, that's one of the attributes of actual land, is it has a perpetual flow of services. Okay, so the soil stays as fertile as it always was. You know, they're taking care not to degrade the soil. You know, to over farm or whatever. And so as long as he can keep doing this forever. And so he can go out and consume $50,000 in consumption goods or services year after year because he's the owner of this real estate. So the question now is, how should we classify this $50,000 per year? On the one hand, it's clearly rent. Why are the sharecroppers paying him $50,000 per year? Because that's the discounted marginal value product of the land. That the, you know, the sharecroppers are looking at their alternative inputs and things, and they're realizing if they pay him for the use of this particular marginal piece of land, they can earn $50,000 more than if they didn't use it. And so that's why they're willing to pay up to $50,000, but because of competition, because we're in the ERE, they in fact pay him $50,000. Because every factor of production gets paid its marginal value product in the ERE, its discounted marginal value product in the ERE. Okay? So that's clearly a rental payment. If that's not rent, then nothing is rent. If you're paying someone to use land, you pay a landlord. I mean, if anybody earns rental payments, it's a landlord. Okay? So it's clearly rent. But now the point is, economically, what is the distinction between that scenario and the first one? In both cases, the capitalist had $1 million in wealth and invested it in an asset that starts throwing off $50,000 annual payments. And so you can see why there's a sense in which you want to say, no, in the second case too, he was earning interest on his capital. Just like in the first example, he was clearly, you say, why did you earn $50,000 a year? You say, oh, because he was earning interest off of his principal. The interest rate's 5%. He had a principal of $1 million, so that's $50,000. And I want to say down here, it's the same thing. He had $1 million principal. The interest rate's 5%. So it has to be the case that he's earning $50,000 per year. Now, what's tricky, what may be throwing you, is it looks like the two processes are different, and they are in a sense. Here, you know, he had a certain amount of bonds he was going to buy, and they had a contractual interest rate built into them, whereas here, what's going on, it's the other way around, at least that's the way you may be thinking of it. It's not that he earns $50,000 a year automatically because, oh, he paid $1 million for the land, and so therefore he's owed contractually 5% of that, and that works out. You do the multiplication, that works out to $50,000, and so that's what the sharecroppers are paying him. No, that's not the way it works. Where that $50,000 comes from is in the supply and demand of rent services for agriculture, for real estate. The farmers don't care how much he paid for the land. All the farmers care about is, this guy is saying he's willing to let us work his land to, you know, take our fertilizer and our hoeing ability and whatever, and get the mule to carry the plow and whatever. And then we'll come at harvest time and we'll gather all the crop. And he's willing to rent that out to us. So we run numbers and we look at the discounted marginal value product and so forth. And we think, okay, we're willing to pay up $50,000. So that's where that $50,000 comes from. So the trick is, because the interest rate is 5%, the fact that this land yield a perpetual stream of rental payments of $50,000 means if you want to buy the parcel of land outright, its market price is capitalized at $1 million. All right, so let me just say that again. The way, as an economist, you deal with this situation is you're not saying, oh, he paid $1 million for the land, we know the interest rate's 5%, so therefore he has to earn $50,000 a year. The causality is the other way around. Because of the marginal productivity of the soil, its usefulness technologically in increasing farm output, the soil's marginal productivity, discounted marginal productivity, is $50,000 per year. You take that fact, and then you say, what's the interest rate? Oh, the interest rate is 5%. So that means the present discounted market value of that perpetual stream of $50,000 annual rents right now the market value of that stream of cash flow is $1 million in present dollars. So that's why to buy the piece of land, the guy has to pay $1 million up front for it. Because, so these two things have to be equal, because if the guy had these opportunities in the bond market, he wouldn't pay more than $1 million for that parcel of land. Because he can get, for $1 million, he can get $50,000 annual payments in the bond market. So down here, if that piece of agriculture, or sorry, that piece of real estate throws off $50,000 a year in income, well then, in equilibrium, it's got to be the case that it too costs $1 million, that it also costs $1 million, right? Because otherwise, people would get out of bonds and get into real estate or vice versa. So the point here is, in the ERE, every land factor has a capitalized market price that is the discounted present market value of its expected future cash flows. And because there's no uncertainty, nobody makes a mistake in that reckoning. So in a sense, the income that the landowners are earning in the ERE is itself interest. They're just earning the interest rate times the original capitalized value of their assets. So yes, the stuff that Peter Klein talked about marginal factor pricing and everything, those principles are all still true. And you can also say it is true that as a landowner, you're getting paid in rent. I mean, yeah, that is true. But the point is, you can also classify those payments as interest on your capital. All right, why don't we move on? Okay, now let me walk. Let's leave the ERE. So now we're going to allow things to change. So first step, the guy uses $1 million to buy a plot of land. And the reason it costs $1 million is that the interest rate was 5%, and the market initially expects that he's going to be able to rent it out to sharecroppers for $50,000 a year. So that's why the price right now had been bid up to $1 million, but not higher and not less, because the market consensus was this particular plot of land, you will be able to rent to sharecroppers, and they'll pay you $50,000 a year perpetually for it. So the current owner says, if somebody wants to buy this from me, I'm going to ask you $1 million for it, because I can look at the bond market and see that you can go ahead and purchase a perpetual stream of $50,000 payments if you're willing to put up $1 million up front, because the interest rate's 5%. Okay? So the guy goes ahead and does that. But we're not in the ERE. People made a mistake. It turns out that this land is actually more physically productive than people realize. The soil is richer than we realized. Or maybe the weather turned out to be better than anybody thought. But it had to be climate turned out to be better. In other words, this isn't just like a temporary thing. People realize, oh, you know what? Before, our best guess was that this land, the owner of this land was going to enjoy a perpetual stream of $50,000 annual payments. We are being too pessimistic. It turns out this land is going to give its owner a perpetual stream of $75,000 annual payments. So now, what goes on here? How do we deal with this? But by the way, the interest rate is still 5%. So nobody has changed their time preferences. The only thing that changed in this example was initially people forecast that this real estate had a certain productivity in terms of the soil's ability to yield crops, such that the owner of it was going to reap $50,000 annual payment. And then turns out, oh my gosh, you put seeds and fertilizer and sunshine and rainfall in this plot of land and more crops pop out than we thought. And so now in the new equilibrium, using, you know, marginal factor pricing theory and principles, you're going to be able to charge sharecroppers in equilibrium $75,000 per year to rent your land. So how do we do the accounting here? There is a one-time capital gain or a profit of $500,000. So the guy originally paid $1 million for the land, and now, holy cow, more crops shoot out than anybody anticipated. So now the market reevaluates, and they say, whoa, the sharecroppers, you can charge them now $75,000. Before, we thought you were only going to earn $50,000, and we have reason to believe that this is a permanent thing. So what happens? It's not, here's the crucial thing, it's not that this guy is going to perpetually earn a higher rate of return on his capital. That's not how you deal with it in terms of the accounting. What happens is right away a one-shot windfall gain of $500,000 happens, where the market price of the land that you paid $1 million for, once people realize their mistake, the market price of the land, boom, jumps up. It goes from $1 million to $1.5 million instantly once people realize their mistake. And then from that point on, you continue to earn 5% annually on principal. So the reason you're still earning 5% interest on your capital wealth. The reason it's $75,000 instead of $50,000 is your capital wealth went up. Right, so let me just say that again, because that's kind of a subtle point. In this example, we didn't mess with time preferences, so the interest rate is still 5% before and after. What we changed is the market's understanding and expectations of the physical productivity of the land, and in particular, how much income the owner of that land is going to be able to derive over time. So initially, when you thought it was going to be a stream of $50,000 payments, the purchase price of the land was $1 million. But now that we realize, oh, you're going to earn a stream of $75,000 annual payments, the initial purchase price goes from $1 million up to $1.5 million, or $1.5 million. So what's happening here is the guy who starts out with $1 million, he has two sources of income now. On one hand, he's going to earn $500,000 in income as a one-time deal. That's profit, or you could call it a capital gain. That's not interest. That $500,000 windfall is not because he was willing to postpone consumption. The $500,000 occurred because he bought an asset that the market had undervalued. Now, maybe he just got lucky. Maybe he didn't know either. Or maybe he did research and he thought, you know, I bet you that land is more productive than most other people realize. Right now, it's selling for $1 million because people think it's going to yield $50,000. But my research tells me that, or my hunch or whatever, tells me that land is actually going to be worth $75,000. Or it could be maybe they're not mistaken about the physical productivity. Maybe the land is used to grow oranges, and maybe everybody thinks the demand for oranges is going to stay the same, but this entrepreneur, no, I think people's tastes are going to change in the future. I think more people are going to want to drink orange juice going forward. So that inequilibrium is going to push up the price of orange juice. That's going to raise how much I can charge the sharecroppers. So it could be there. It's not necessarily that the market was wrong about the physical productivity. Maybe they were wrong about demand for the products that this thing was going to yield. That's a possibility. Okay, but whatever reason, this guy is earning $500,000 as a one-shot thing. And then if he chooses to say that as well, right, so the land goes up, and then he doesn't mortgage off the extra capital gain, and he just consumes the rent that the land throws off every year. The reason he's earning $75,000 now is purely because of interest. Okay, so what happened is initially he got a $500,000 windfall and he decided to save it. He just, okay, he let his assets get capitalized by an extra $500,000. So that was income. If he wanted to, he could have gone and consumed that $500,000. You know, he went out on a yacht and then used the extra $25,000 per year to service that outside debt. And then he just would have been the same, you know, in terms of his cash flow going forward, except he would have had that one-time extravagance of going on a cruise and blowing 500 grand, right? I hope I'm not confusing you guys. He could have done that, but he chose not to. He got an extra 500,000, and he just let that go ahead and be incorporated into his net wealth. So his capital went up by 500,000 because he had a higher income and saved it. And then from that point forward, he's earning 5% year after year on his 1.5 million, which works out to $75,000. Okay? So again, the big picture here is, since we're outside the ERE, the market initially was undervaluing that land, and that's why this guy earned two sources of income. The one in the one-time shot when the market realized its mistake and corrected the factor pricing, so he earned that windfall. And in our example, he just chose to save it. And then he earned 5% on his capital because of time preference. So if you say, well, wait a minute, isn't he earning rent also? Yeah, he's earning rent. The sharecroppers are renting the land from him. That $75,000 per year, you could with perfect legitimacy call those rental payments and say that his income every year is rent due to the marginal productivity of his land. Those are all true statements, but the point is, from a certain perspective, it's also interest accruing on the capitalized market value of his land and or on any asset that he owns. All right, so you guys should know the general picture. I mean, if you're getting a little bit lost in the details, it's not the end of the world, but I did want you to think through these things to see this is the Austrian approach to these things. And it's not idiosyncratic. I mean, if you're an accountant working for a corporation, this is the way you deal with this stuff. But my point is other schools of thought don't dwell on these topics as much as the Austrians. I think the Austrians think through the nature of capital and interest and its relation to rental prices a lot more deeply than other schools of thought. So that's why I'm spending so much time on this. But again, if you are curious why in the opening part of Chapter 8 does Rothbard not talk about rent, this is why. Because he's saying in the ERE, all durable land factors, they have their rents fully incorporated into the current capital market value. And so in one sense, the income you derive from that is just interest off of that. Even though to determine what those rental payments are, you need to know marginal productivity theory. And then outside the ERE, there's another source of income, and that's from capital gains. If you were fortunate enough to acquire a resource that was underpriced by the market initially, then when the market realizes its mistake and adjusts upward in a one-shot fell swoop, the price of your asset, that's a one-time capital gain that is income to you that period that you can choose to save or you can consume it if you want, but that is income. Okay. Another point, you might say, okay, but why stop at rent? Using that same approach, why couldn't you say that in the evenly rotating economy, there's only one source of income, interest? And that even wages are really just a form of interest on human capital. So why don't we say, okay, I'm a worker. My salary is going to be $50,000 every year. Since we're in the evenly rotating economy, I'm not going to die. You know, I'm just going to live forever because nothing changes. And why don't I then say that you know, if the market rate of interest is 5%, the capitalized value of me as a worker is $1 million. And so in a sense, since I own my body, I have an asset worth $1 million. And yeah, technically you can say I'm earning wages every year of $50,000 due to the marginal productivity of my labor. But from another perspective, it's equally legitimate to say, really, I'm just earning 5% per year off of my $1 million in human capital. So you could say that if you want to, and many economists would say that, or they would if they knew the way Austrians think about rent, okay? They would think, okay, well, yeah, if you're going to say an ERE, rent is really just a manifestation, too, of interest on the capitalized value of land factors, well, then by the same token, wages are a manifestation of the interest that you're earning off the capitalized value of a human being. And if you had, you know, a robot, it would be clearer that if, you know, you had something that was clearly owned by somebody that was that was performing services that sure looked like labor, and that you could rent the robot out and it would go do services and the people would pay you rental payments, but you were the owner of the robot, and then you could also sell the robot on the open market, and you would, yeah, you could call it rent, or sorry, wages, since it's kind of like labor, since it's a humanoid thing, but clearly you would be earning an interest return on your capital. So the reason Murray Rothbard doesn't want to go down that route is he thinks that slavery. That to say, for Rothbard, this notion of human capital is a bit of a misnomer. That you can't actually sell your body to somebody else. That even though Rothbard says you own your body, because if you don't own it, who does, right? Even so, it's not alienable. You can't transfer the ownership of your body to some other party. Right? Now, we don't have time tonight, and I don't want to get into it. There is a controversy here. So Walter Block, I mean, the positions get very nuanced, but I'm pretty sure that Walter Block thinks in a free market, you can sell yourself into slavery. You know, that initially you own yourself, that's the default position. But if for some reason you wanted to, why couldn't you sign a contract with somebody that says, you know, I'm selling you ownership of my body and you're going to give me a lump sum payment right now for that. Instead of me, because what happens in a wage contract is, in a sense, you're renting your body to somebody else. You're saying for a specific period of time, I'm going to give you the flow of services that my physical body performs, and you're the rightful owner of that output. So if I go to your factory and produce stuff on your assembly line, I can't go to court and say, what the heck, that car that popped out of the assembly line is mine because I use my labor to transform it, and so that's my property. The owner of the factory is going to say, what are you talking about? I gave you wages. I paid you for your labor services. So the idea is, well, if I can sell my labor to somebody, in a sense, that means I'm just renting my body. Why couldn't I, instead of me working for you year after year and getting paid $50,000, why don't you just give me $1 million right now, and then I'm agreeing you have the ownership of my labor services forever. And then basically I just sold myself into slavery to you. And you could, in a contract, you could specify, like, restrictions that you can't beat me or you can't deprive me of food or whatever. But the point is, Block's point is, why can't I do that? You know, if you say I'm the owner of a horse, I can sell the horse to somebody. So if I own my body, why can't I sell my body to somebody? I think that's Block's position. Okay, so I said I wasn't going to get into this. I'm sort of getting sucked into it. If you're curious, Rothbard doesn't like that because he says you can't alienate your will. Like, what if 3 years from now you don't like the contract you know, you may have agreed to sell your physical services, but you can't right now agree that your future self is going to like the arrangement. And so, you know, you can't sell your will. You can't sell your future agreement to that. So that's why it doesn't really make sense that you can only sell on the spot market your services at any given time and get payment for it, but you can't sell your body itself to somebody else. All right. So whether or not you agree with that, that's not the point. The point is, since Rothbard thinks that, since that's his position, he's saying we don't use that same of looking at wage payments over time in the ERE, using the interest rate to discount them all into present values and then come up with what's the capitalized market price of a human being right now, and then interpreting the wage payments every year as just the interest on your human capital. Because Rothbard's saying, we don't actually have a market price for your body because you can't sell yourself into slavery. You can sell the land. We can buy and sell the parcel of land for dollars. And so that, you know, there clearly we are capitalizing those rental payments. But we can't go around buying and selling human beings to know what their capitalized value is. At best, that's a metaphor. So that's why he thinks that wages are still an ultimate source of income in the ERE, whereas rent, he thinks, can itself be in a, reduced to interest. Okay. Moving on. In the real world, what happens is the capitalist entrepreneurs whittle away these pure profit opportunities. And in so doing, they move factor prices toward where they would be in the ERE if nothing else changed. Okay, so in that original example we were working with, the actual data support a price of $1.5 million for that parcel of land. Because in practice, the owner of that land is going to earn $75,000. So the initial price of $1 million was just wrong. So when the capitalist entrepreneur buys the land for $1 million, and then he starts earning $75,000, people are going to say, oh, wait a minute, that was a mistake, and then the market price of the land is going to get bid up to $1.5 million. So the idea is entrepreneurs looking for profits, by seizing them, they tend to drive them out of existence. Or a better idea is if somebody sees, I'm trying to think. Suppose the way that example plays out is that it's not that the soil is more physically productive. Suppose that there's an increase in demand for oranges because tastes change. There's a new report from the FDA saying drinking orange juice has health benefits we didn't realize before. So now people want to drink more orange juice. That pushes up the demand for oranges. There's only so much land that can be used for oranges. So in the new equilibrium, the market price of oranges is higher. Therefore, that piece of land that's technologically capable of shooting out oranges now gives you a higher rent. So initially, the market's responding to that shift in demand. The people who are in orange production are earning above average rates of return. If you're just looking at how much did they spend in money terms and how much are they earning, so more people are jumping into orange production. On the margin, certain entrepreneurs are, instead of planting apples, are now planting oranges. The idea is that there's a transition period at the market's responding to the new information or realizing their past mistakes. And then when all is said and done, if there were no further changes, if that was just a one-shot up increase in the demand for oranges and no more changes, eventually all the prices would be recalibrated to that new reality, and we would be in the ERE. But in the real world, things keep changing so that there's a change. The economy, through the profit incentive, entrepreneurs start pushing market prices to accord with those new realities. But before we get there, some other change happens. Up, and now we're moving toward that target. World, we're never in the ERE because things keep changing. The economy, like, there's a moving target that the economy keeps adapting towards, and the entrepreneurs in view who are responsible for that adaptation. That's what their role is socially. Okay, so the slide about arbitrage. Pure profits and losses are due to mispriced factors of production. So in the Austrian view, and this really comes from Ludwig von Mises, and then, you know, his views were elaborated by Israel Kirzner and Murray Rothbard, but this is like the heart of Mises' view of how a market economy works. And this is why Mises thought that entrepreneurs were the driving force of the market. So the successful entrepreneurs, what do? They look out and they see the future better than other people do. The successful entrepreneurs look out at the array of market prices for factors, and they forecast what consumers will be willing to pay for various types of products and services, and they use their knowledge of technological relationships to see what sort of physical factors could be transformed into those future goods and services to be sold to consumers. And the successful, profitable entrepreneurs, they look out and they say, oh, you know what? Some of these prices, some of these factors are being underpriced by the market, meaning I can swoop in, buy them up, so, you know, either buying capital goods or renting the use of capital equipment or buying natural resources or renting the use of land and paying wages to workers. And I think I see opportunities where I can jump into a particular line, pay for the factors that I need to physically create a product or service, and I anticipate that I'll be able to sell it for such a revenue stream that my rate of return in doing that operation will be higher than the going rate of interest. So I can earn a higher rate of return on my investment doing that than I can earn elsewhere. And the market in general, my peers, don't see it. They overlook this opportunity that I am observant enough to spot. Because they had seen it. If my colleagues saw the situation the way I'm analyzing it, then they would jump at that. They're earning 5% on bonds, they're earning 5% on renting, you know, buying real estate and renting it out to sharecropper, and I see this one particular thing where I can earn 8%. And so how do you explain that? Well, it's because those factors are underpriced. So once I jump in there and then people realize the mistake, what happens is more entrepreneurs flock into that line too. And in so doing, they eventually whittle away the opportunity. Because the more people that get into it, there's two things going on. More people are trying to buy those factors that are physically necessary to make the product or service, so that tends to push up the price of those factors. And then at the same time, the more people who get into that line of work, or that industry, or that sector, or whatever, they're increasing the output of the goods down the road once the factors, you know, are used technologically to create the finished product or service. So now the output of that is higher, so that means it's going to push down its price. So the gap, the margin, the, you know, rate of return that you're going to earn in terms of your monetary investment gets lowered because the input prices go up and the output price goes down. The more people that jump on this opportunity, and that process stops, the rate of return in doing that particular thing is no better than the going rate of interest. Let me first jump into this slide, the Kirzner-Rothbard thing. I just want to finish that train of thought. So, continuing with what I just said, Mises thought that what the profitable entrepreneurs did is they better arrange society's scarce resources to satisfy the consumers. Because if you think through, what does it mean? We just said the way you earn profits as an entrepreneur is you look out at the world and you see, hey, wait a minute, there are some resources over there that I could buy for a relatively low price and transform them into a product or service that I could sell for a relatively high. And when I use the term low and high, what I mean is those two numbers in relationship to each other imply a return that's greater than the going rate of income. So Mises thought that in general, what the entrepreneurs are doing, they are the ones that enter the factor markets on behalf of the consumers. Because the entrepreneurs who are looking ahead saying, what do the consumers want? When they go to the store with their paychecks, they want to buy stuff. So I, as the entrepreneur, I'm going to try to give it to them. And I'm looking around, and to do so, I need to buy factors of production. So it's the entrepreneurs who are in between the factor owners and the consumers. In Mises' conception, it's the entrepreneurs who are acting on behalf of the consumers. Because the consumers don't know enough. The consumer doesn't know how a movie is made. The consumer just knows, I'm going to go spend $20 for a new 3D Blockbuster or whatever the price is. Or I'm only willing to spend $5 for a movie that's very poorly made. And, you know, the audio is 2 seconds off the video and that kind of stuff. So the consumer knows what he likes. He doesn't know how to make it. It's the entrepreneurs who know how to make things. And so it's their job. They're the ones that go out and try to supply it for the consumer. So the point is, an entrepreneur who makes a profit, what that means is he saw that, wait a minute, the consumers really want this particular good or service, and right now there's a deficiency in providing it for them. That I can go out with the amount they're willing to pay me to give them this thing, that's more than enough for me to go buy the factors needed to produce it. And so that's the sense in which that particular good or service is being under-provided by the market right now. And so it's only when I start giving those consumers more of that that pushes up the price of those factors and pushes down the equal price of the good or service. And once that's back to the normal rate of interest, now we see all is well with the world, that we're producing enough of that product. So the thing to realize, the crucial insight here, is that the prices of the factors of production, that's like a signal to all the other entrepreneurs saying, keep off this thing, or use with care, I should say. So the market price of a factor of production, where does that come from? Well, that comes from all the entrepreneurs who are bidding on it. So, for example, I like to use in my principles classes. Technologically, you could build an apartment building using a lot of gold. And in fact, consumers would think that was cool. Like, if price weren't a factor, you know, weren't a consideration, I should say, if you were going to live in an apartment building, wouldn't it be cool if the walls were coated with solid gold and the toilet was made out of solid gold and the sink was solid gold and stuff like that? Or maybe not solid, but coated with gold. You know, you wouldn't want to sit on it and sink into it or something. Okay? So you see the point. That would be awesome. But why doesn't anyone do that? No apartment building, at least in a market economy, uses a lot of actual gold. And the reason is that it would be unprofitable. That the amount that consumers would be willing to pay to live in an apartment building that had a bunch of gold in it would not justify the higher expense of building it that way. It would be unprofitable to do it that way. So one way of interpreting it is to say, oh, the gold is too expensive. And I say, oh, yeah, you could never do it. That would be too expensive. But my point is, the reason gold is so expensive is that other producers, other entrepreneurs use it in their things. So it's not, so a jeweler is in the business of making necklaces for women. He thinks that gold, it makes sense to use gold in his line of work. Because he says, yeah, consumers would pay more for a gold necklace than for a silver necklace. and running the numbers, they would pay me so much more that it makes sense, it's profitable for me to produce some gold necklaces, even though the guys building apartment units never conclude that, oh yeah, some of my units I'll coat with gold. That doesn't make any, that never works. But with jewelers or people who make jewelry, they do often conclude that, yeah, okay, for these particular units, I'm going to use gold quite extensively. And so the point is, it's not that gold in general is too expensive to use. Rather, it's that the consumers want gold to be used in jewelry, not to be wasted coating apartment buildings. The way the market expresses that desire on the part of consumers is there's a very high price per unit of gold to make sure it is allocated very carefully. So that the people building apartments don't even think about using gold because its price is too high. But the people